The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Awesome. How's everyone doing today? Everyone awake? Yeah? Okay. Cool. Awesome. So who here has actually heard of the American Indian Movement as an organization? Okay, good. That's a good amount. Great. In 1968, 50 years ago, the American Indian Movement was founded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and was the organizational expression of the Red Power Movement. Oftentimes, the start of the Red Power Movement was said to have started when the Indians of all tribes from 1969 to 71 occupied the Alcatraz Island off San Francisco. This kind of marked the beginning of the most intense decade of Native American protests in the 20th century. As many of you know, and probably have gone to some sessions already, 1968 was a year where the world was on fire. There was the general strike in France. It was the height of the Black Power movement. The anti-war protests that happened outside the Democratic National Committee and the Chicago police in this city beating the crap out of them, and much, much more. But oftentimes when we talk about the radicalization that happened in the 60s and the 70s, we often forget about AIM as well as the Red Power Movement and the who were outgrowths of resistance to settler colonialism and capitalism and the revolutionary fever that was happening in 1968. So in this talk, I'm going to attempt to give you an insight to the rise of AIM and more broadly the Red Power Movement. I will start by kind of giving some context to what the fight looked like, starting around the Wounded Knee Massacre in 1890 and the brutal policy of assimilation following that massacre, and then explore the rise of the Red Power Movement itself and the details of the American Indian Movement and what pressures they face, especially from the FBI, and actually detail some of the actions that they orchestrated and the relationship specifically between urban and reservation Indians. And I can kind of conclude by discussing a little bit what AIM is doing today, and more importantly, what their legacy is, and how things have changed because of them, and what we can learn from them. And a little bit of note about terms, I'll be kind of using interchangeably the words American Indian, Indigenous, Native, Native American, and Indian interchangeably in regards to the context. So on December 29th, 1890, the 7th Cavalry of the United States killed at least 150 and as many as 300 people at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, which is now located on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Many historians and natives saw this as the turning point after a long fight against relentless U.S. capitalist expansion westward. This is often referred to as the end of the Indian Wars and kind of the start of the full assimilation policy that would go on until the 1970s. This massacre is a key point to the physical brutality of the time period, but the passage of the Dawes Act, which happened in 1887, was really the start of the assimilation into the capitalist economy. The Dawes Act systematically reduced the lands held by natives in the West and attempted to integrate them into the system of American capitalism by undoing any type of notion of collective ownership. This essentially divided up collectively owned land and gave them individual plots that was 160 acres to each head of household. This really systematically eliminated this collective ownership that many nations had at that time. Natives who took possession of their parcel of land and adopted quote-unquote civilized life, such as farming and living in nuclear families instead of tribal units, they were so graciously granted U.S. citizenship. One of the most important provisions of this was the various reservations that were split up into these parcels. The surplus land that was left over was opened up to settlers, railroads, corporations, and national parks. When the Dawes Act was passed in 1887, Indians held 130 million acres of land. And by 1934, when that policy was overturned, they held 48 million acres of land. And nearly half of this land was arid or semi-arid desert, and in the process, this made 900,000 natives landless. During this time, much like immigrant children that are being separated from their families today, many natives were stolen from their families and their nations to be assimilated into Indian trade schools, which assimilated them by beating them when they spoke their language and practiced their culture. They were also taught a trade so they could be integrated into the working class of America. Many natives started flooding into cities following their schoolings. Some became workers facing racism. Others were disillusioned and went back home. But both places, they did not feel like they belonged. Being in a white-dominated culture or going back home into reservations where they have lost their language and their cultural practices and not being able to connect with their elders. In an effort to restore some of that was lost, the federal government was pressured during the New Deal era to pass the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. This was considered the Indian New Deal. The bill finally it ended the Dawes Act, but it also gave back some level of sovereignty to Indians by quote unquote creating governments where they could have an elected tribal council. However, tribal constitutions had to be approved by the federal government, and constitutions by no means could have had any form of traditional governance. So many American Indians lived either in extremely, and still do to this day, in extremely impoverished Indian reservations or within urban centers that are often referred to as red ghettos. Natives have always come into cities for work, as I kind of mentioned, after the trade school policy and assimilation policy. This migration of natives into cities was dramatically increased when the U.S. started to implement what is called a termination policy in 1953. This is a policy that I would say most people don't know. And this was started in 1953. And on August 1st, Congress passed a resolution, House concurrent resolution that said, quote, directed that the end of reservations and federal services and protections to be completed as rapidly as possible. Charles Wilkinson, in his book Blood Struggle, described how termination was and still is viewed by natives. Quote, termination meant total assimilation for some tribes now, for others soon. Apprehension turned into fear and panic as the words of ACR 108 spread across Indian country. Even today, a half century later, for Indian people, the word termination represents the third rail, shorthand for all that is extreme in federal Indian policy. As Wilkerson said, this was the total assimilation, and the government wanted natives off their books and wanted to eliminate any type of land claim or quote-unquote special rights, aka treaty rights that were negotiated from nation to nation, and finally end what was called the Indian problem, and not recognize tribes as actual nations. What this actually looked like was the government handpicking a couple native nations that they thought were the quote-unquote most advanced and eliminate their reservation and federal relationship to the government and hand over jurisdiction to the state. For example, the Menominee, which are located 5 hours north of here in Wisconsin, was the first tribe to be this test. Their reservation was eliminated and jurisdiction was handed over to the state of Wisconsin and were treated like any other county in Wisconsin without any national identity. Menominee land became easier to sell and privatize so the county could maintain a tax base. They could not maintain any type of local tax structure without selling their land. And after this policy was implemented, the Menominee were devastated as their land claims as a nation was eliminated. The idea of nation-to-nation relationship and treaty rights would be eliminated, and if the government was going to have it their way, this was going to spread throughout Indian country and the United States. And in addition, along with this, during this policy, the federal government would give one-way bus tickets for natives to leave their reservations with the promise of good jobs. And there was a huge influx of natives into cities like Minneapolis, Milwaukee, Chicago, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, a lot of Western cities. This policy can be viewed kind of as a great migration of natives into cities, like the blacks in the south to the north. But this was official government policy. In 1960, only 28% of natives lived in urban areas. By 1970, 44% did. And today, 78% of natives live off reservations, and 72% live in cities or suburban areas. Termination was absolutely devastating to Indian communities. But the policy was a double-edged sword. It brought thousands of Indians together in a small place and created a certain pan-Indianness that did not exist since Tecumseh's effort in the early 1800s to build a pan-Indian resistance to Western expansion. Peter Mathewson spoke about termination's relationship to the rise of the Red Power movement. He said, quote, "Although much of its inspiration derived from Indian fishing rights battles already underway in Washington and Oregon, from Six Nations land protests in Ontario and New York, and from the Red Power activity that evolved out of the civil rights activism on the West Coast, AIM came into existence as a direct result of termination relocation programs that dumped thousands of bewildered Indians into the cities. Even those who received job training found themselves faced with open racism and discrimination, receiving the lowest wages for the dirtiest, most onerous work, and living in the worst conditions of urban blight and official neglect." Once in cities, even while on reservation, American Indians faced racial profiling of the police and became one of the most disproportionately represented groups in prisons. In urban centers, many started to fight for healthcare rights, which was guaranteed to many natives in via treaty rights, but at the time you could not find an Indian health services outside of reservations. In 1962, the National Indian Youth Council was formed during this time as an activist response to the more conservative organization known as the National Congress of American Indians to termination. Many of the activists in the National Indian Youth Council became members of AIM later, and this organization really set the foundations for AIM. This was only the beginning of what was to come. At the time, the American Indian Movement in 1968, American Indians, they were founded, obviously, the AIM was, as I mentioned, founded in Minneapolis. They represented 10% of the population in Minneapolis, while they were 70% of the city's jail population. In fact, many of the founders of AIM actually first met in prison. Clyde Belcourt and Eddie Batine Benin were Ojibwe inmates in 1962 at Minnesota Stillwater Prison and started reading about the civil rights movement and the Black Panthers and much more. This was their first taste of organizing. They organized 47 native prisoners to start, as Belcourt said, quote, "education about being Indians instead of just rotting in prison making license plates. I guess we had the first real Indian studies program in the country." Many natives who were in jail were there for poor people crimes, essentially, on low-level crimes, but stayed in jail because they could not make bail. It's important to note that throughout this time between the Indian Reorganization Act in 34 and the termination that started in 53, natives were fighting the whole time. They'd been fighting for treaty rights, hunting rights, fishing rights, and throughout the country. So the resistance had always been present, but the explosion of AIM was just about to happen. You know, as more and more Indians became radicalized and were seeing the horrors of termination with no jobs, police violence, and many took inspiration from the Black Power movement, radical natives developed their own Red Power, as they called it. In July 1968, in Minneapolis, Eddie Batine Benin, Clyde Belcourt, George Mitchell, and Dennis Banks founded what was originally called the Concerned Indian Americans. Obviously, because of this acronym, they quickly changed the name to the American Indian Movement. The original goal of AIM was fighting police violence, specifically in the native neighborhood of Franklin, inside Minneapolis. mainly founded by Ojibwe people in the area whose homelands are close to Lake Superior in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. It was an urban organization, part of this pan-Indian movement, but didn't have much connection to the reservation life at its founding, as it was mainly helping to patrol the police and protect Indians from brutality from the police. In the book Like a Hurricane, Paul Chad Smith and Robert Allen Warrior discuss the intentions of AIM, saying, quote, "One of the first projects of the new group was AIM Patrol. AIM raised money to equip cars with two-way radios, cameras, and tape recorders so they could monitor arrests of the police department. When the AIM patrol heard police dispatch to certain bars or street corners, officers would be met by Indians in red jackets, carefully observing their actions. AIM also became experts at providing attorneys for those arrested. It was a tactic similar to the Black Panther campaigns to monitor the police in Oakland, California, and other cities." This was an extremely valuable piece to the organization. As the authors alluded to, the Black Panthers' political origins were very similar. You have a community that is not protected by the police whatsoever, and historically has every reason not to trust the government or the police. Even the most famous Indian resistor, Sitting Bull, in the late 1800s was shot and killed by Indian police. A group like AIM was needed to actually protect the community. Smith and Warrior go on to explain the rootedness of what AIM had in their communities, saying, quote, "As a political program, it may not have been as ambitious as halting a threatened termination of an embattled tribe or even seizing an abandoned prison, but it spoke volumes about its rootedness that AIM enjoyed in a specific place. The AIM office was a place to stop by if you needed a ride, an emergency loan, leads on jobs, or a place to live. Social services and political actions were integrated. If you had been evicted and needed a lawyer, Clyde or Dennis could probably help. And if your nephew faced humiliation of acting in what you considered a soul-scarring piece of racist garbage, they would get people together at dawn and drive over and talk some sense into a school principal." Though its political program at first was murky, the program evolved and developed through action and organizing and the inspiration and successes of the civil rights movement at the time. The core of the foundation of AIM was in the urban centers, and many of these natives had been ripped away from their homelands, with many not knowing their language or culture due to American policy, which I had noted earlier. Many longed and sought for their identity. Some traditionals, who often spoke their native tongue as their first language, lived on reservations and had been fighting to keep traditions alive, although practicing such traditions at the time were illegal. These traditionals had been fighting oppression for years, but had no connection to AIM. And this was about to change. AIM chapters started springing up everywhere in the country. Organization was growing at a rapid rate. Though they had a central board, it wasn't super strict organization. It was often very decentralized, as the growth and demand was hard to keep up with. It was hard to keep up with the people who identified as AIM, who were actually part of AIM. So it was a little bit confusing at many times. Despite the growth, mainly in urban areas, the organization still obviously faced this issue of connection to reservation people. It was about to change in a little border town of Gordon, Nebraska. Gordon is a border town of Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, just about 30 minutes south drive of the reservation line. Much like any other reservation border town, there is extremely strained relations between Indians and white folks. Racism runs rampant. It's not uncommon to hear people use the R word or distinguish the difference between a quote-unquote good Indian and bad Indian. In February 1972, a Lakota man named Raymond Yellow Thunder was murdered for simply being Indian, and his murderers posted bail. Paul Chad Smith and Robert Allen Warrior in Like a Hurricane wrote that, with extreme clarity, discussing the differences between what was a normal occurrence, an Indian man being killed by white people in a border town, to how this time it was different. Raymond Yellow Thunder's death would be different. In the space of just a few days, Indian residents of Gordon and Pine Ridge would rise up in an unprecedented demand for justice. And the American Indian Movement, which the people of Pine Ridge would call upon to support their efforts, would emerge as the single most influential Indian organization in the country. Not just in cities where their message had already been gaining a place of prominence, but among the reservation people as well. Yellow Thunder was from Pine Ridge, and his family was originally seeking assistance from the tribe as well as the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and heard absolutely nothing. And that's when the family turned to AIM, and they didn't disappoint. They brought caravans upon caravans to Gordon alongside the Oglala Lakota people, which Pine Ridge is their home, flooded the small town of Gordon and demanded justice to be served to the murderers of Yellow Thunder. This unexpected response by Indian people reached out to folks all around the country and forced the Gordon government to indict and convict Yellow Thunder's murderers. Russell Means, who was a prominent leader of AIM and was also Oglala Lakota but grew up in the Bay Area, helped to bridge the gap between AIM and the Lakota people in Pine Ridge. Gordon was a turning point for AIM. They became a trusted organization by traditionals on Pine Ridge and around the country. They proved that they could walk the walk. The position that AIM put themselves into no doubt frightened the government, because they had the ability now to connect two people that distinctly were separated, intentionally separated, and so this was going to be the powerhouse that they were going to build. Later that year in 72, in November, AIM organized alongside other groups for a caravan of over 500 American Indians to come to D.C. and discuss the situation facing natives with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The caravan was called the Trail of Broken Treaties. There was no intention at the start to take over the Bureau of Indian Affairs building. While in Minneapolis, they developed a 20-point position paper and brought these organizations together. I don't have time to list off all 20, but I'll list off four. One was restoration of treaty making, which ended by Congress in 1871. All Indians to be governed by treaty relations. The restoration of 110 million acres of land taken away from Native nations by the United States. And the abolishment of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Very much like our call for the abolishment of ICE. The caravan arrived to D.C. the evening of November 3rd. There were some misunderstandings about their plans for housing, so they just showed up at the BIA and they demanded meetings to help with a place to stay. However, it was directed to all employees of the BIA not to help them whatsoever. So by 5 p.m., they ordered the protesters to leave. The protesters refused, and they ordered everyone out. And they barricaded all the entrance with desks and chairs. And they proceeded to go outside, take down the American flag, and turn it upside down and put it back on up. And this was the flag of the movement, and this is actually kind of important. The natives are disproportionately represented in the military as well, and according to the flag code, the only time you put a flag upside down is when the country's in distress, and natives have been in distress ever since the establishment of the United States. So this was all during the 1972 presidential election, which was days away. So the communication between the federal government during this time was anywhere from non-existent to horrible. This was the last thing Nixon wanted to deal with. Inside the building, protesters burned files and smuggled an estimated 12 tons of paper out of the building. These papers were never found. And I feel like this is extremely important. The BIA is viewed as the oppressor and occupying these lands, and you can imagine burning these documents and taking these documents that are a kind of representation of oppression was extremely important to many of these natives. Though the occupation ended only a few days later with little food and water to sustain itself, the BIA ended up making a deal with the protesters and helped with expenses and not to charge them, but this put them on the national map. And so following this, you know, there's a lot of momentum building. I mean, you can see all these actions are actually very close together in time. They started I already talked about Gordon, Nebraska. They Ames started a border town campaign, really trying to fight racism at these border towns. So following the occupation, they specifically wanted to go to Rapid City, South Dakota. This is the most populous city in western South Dakota, which I guess isn't saying much. It's about 67,000, which is in the center of the Black Hills, which is the most sacred land to the Lakota and was stolen and is surrounded by six different Lakota reservations. Rapid, which is what it's called by many of the locals, has a significant native population as well. Still to this day, it is 12.4% of the population. Many natives in Rapid lived in public housing at the time, and most still do. And much like their experience being pushed off their land in the Black Hills, these projects continued to move around the city as gentrification and growth happened in Rapid. Much like Gordon, it was not unusual for natives to face racism or even be murdered by local whites or by the police. The idea behind the campaign was to target various locations from large to small businesses towards the local government officials, simply demanding to be treated better and to take the social and economic concerns seriously and address poverty, racism, and unemployment. So as this was all happening, at the time, in 1972, Wesley Bad Heart Bear, a Lakota man, was killed in Buffalo Gap, South Dakota, which is just outside the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. It was just outside a bar, and his murderer was initially arrested and charged with manslaughter, and the case was to be decided at the town of Custer, South Dakota, which is named by the famous Indian fighter George Custer, and also who was famously killed by the Lakota at the Battle of Little Bighorn in 1876. Aim came in full force to confront the court, because the murderer was only spent one night in jail and was let out on bail for $5,000. Once Aim arrived in Custer, snow was falling, and they had a hearing to hear from the Indian community, but the many of the protesters were not allowed in the building inside the courthouse, as Aim was not allowed. So as a result, a riot ensued between Aimsters and the local Custer police. Cops and Aimsters started fighting each other. And there's these powerful images that you can find out there. And you can imagine all this pent-up anger by many of the Lakota who have had for centuries been exploited in the area, kind of exploding that day. And that actual explosion came out in the flames of cars being burned. There was a building that housed the local Chamber of Commerce was burned down to the ground. And the police arrested dozens of Indians, including AIM leaders Russell Means and Dennis Banks, and even the mother of Wesley, Sarah Bad Heart. So this kind of all kind of leads up to one of the most famous moments of AIM, which is known as Wounded Knee 2. So during this time of the border town campaign, Pine Ridge was kind of run, and this goes for many of the reservations at that time, run like a dictatorship that the U.S. supports. It's the home of the Oglala Lakota and just south of Rapid City. The U.S. government was funneling money to Dick Wilson, who was the tribal council president and who oversaw the reservation like an iron fist. Supporters of AIM were hunted down by his personal army called the Guardians of the Oglala Nation, or the Goon Squad, ending in numerous gun battles. The Goon Squad worked closely with the FBI and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Since Wilson was so unpopular, resistance developed on the reservation. The organization called the Oglala Sioux Civil Rights Organization was formed to impeach Wilson. Petitions were filed, and one even had more signatures than the votes that Wilson got in the preceding election. Showing his nepotism and corruption, Wilson personally presided over his impeachment hearings. As the Oglala Sioux Civil Rights Organization was kind of at a loss at this point. You know, they went through all the proper channels to try to get rid of this guy. They called a meeting, and over 200 people came to a hearing put together on to decide whether to allow AIM, to invite AIM into the reservation, because at this point AIM was not allowed, because if they came on, Wilson would send its squad. And so they were debating on whether they should call them on in. And during that meeting, Frank Fool's Crow, one of the traditional chiefs of the Oglala people, said, quote, "Go ahead and do it. Take your brothers from the American Indian Movement and go to Wounded Knee and make your stand there." On February 27, 1973, no, this is only months after the occupation of the BIA. I mean, this is, once again, these are all very close by. A caravan of 300 armed Oglala Lakota and AIM activists arrived at Wounded Knee and declared it a liberated territory. They took over the church that was there and the trading posts and blocked all the roads and took several white hostages. The leading participants included Leonard Crow Dog, Carter Camp, Madonna Thunderhawk, Russell Means, and Dennis Banks. As AIM leader Dennis Banks said, quote, "The message that went out is that that a band of Indians could take on the U.S. government. Tecumseh had his day, Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, we had ours." And Russell Means described the necessity of their action, saying, quote, "We were about to be obliterated culturally. Our spiritual way of life, our entire way of life, was about to be stamped out. And this was a rebirth of our dignity and self-pride." Within hours of the start of the occupation, the federal government mobilized an overwhelming response, sending over 200 FBI agents, federal marshals, and BIA police to surround and blockade Wounded Knee. Just the scene, it's Wounded Knee is really just a grassy area with a mass grave from the massacre in 1890. It's not like a big city, so it's an open area. So the senators from South Dakota came to try to negotiate freedom for the hostages. Oh, this is my favorite story. So they learned quickly that the hostages were sympathetic to the Indian cause and were not staying against their will. Agnes Gilversleeve, the owner of the trading post, said, quote, "We're not hostages. We are going to remain here. It's your fault these Indians are here. Have you listened to them? We're not leaving because you'll kill them if we leave." Shootouts happened almost every night of the occupation. Leonard Crow Dog, one of the spiritual leaders, would lead people in sweat lodges and ceremonies to prepare for battle as if it were to come every day. These ceremonies were actually really important to the resistance in developing a sense of Native pride, as American Indians, as I mentioned earlier, were not legally allowed to practice any of their religion or culture at the time. The demands of the occupiers were actually quite simple. Investigate corruption in the reservation, have hearings in Congress on broken treaties, yet the government immediately rejected these demands, sending mid-level officials to deal with the situation and give out ultimatums to the occupiers to leave Wounded Knee. All these documents that were sent to AIM, they would burn in front of the cameras, which is pretty awesome. The mainstream media broadcast continued to try to demonize AIM and try to turn public opinion against the movement. Nevertheless, the occupation gained sympathy throughout the U.S., with majorities saying that they sided with the Indians. Actor Marlon Brando actually refused during this time to accept his Oscar for Best Actor in The Godfather in protest and in solidarity with Native rights and against the stereotypes that Indians were portrayed in movies, and he sent up Apache actress Sechin Littlefeather, who gave a speech refusing the award, and millions watched it. The occupation was taking place as the Watergate scandal was rocking the Nixon administration. So you can imagine the administration didn't want to look any worse than they already were looking. So this is important too, because it wouldn't be unheard of the federal marshals going in and kicking them out, but they did not want those optics going on during this time, especially the optics of it being at the site of the 1890 massacre of Wounded Knee. And AIM and Lakota activists were able to build solidarity around the country as supplies continued to flood in. We can put this, kind of parallel this as a Standing Rock as kind of our generation's wounded knee too. Thousands of people came to participate, including American Indians from different tribes and around the country alongside white, Chicano, black, and Asian activists. And it's really compelling when you read this and how similar it can be to what happened at Standing Rock. A small delegation led by Frank Fools Crow actually even went to the United Nations in an attempt to be recognized as the occupation's autonomy as a liberated nation. You can imagine the request was denied. Meanwhile, the response from the FBI was a go out against the occupation. Former FBI agent Joe Trimbrock later recalled saying, quote, "The FBI director said, Tell Trimbrock he can have anything he wants," which was pretty neat because it was like having a blank check. "I had agents go up to Rapid City and buy every rifle they could find." The U.S. government was worried worried that Wounded Knee would become examples for others to follow. A high-ranking BIA official expressed alarm over the view of Wounded Knee had, quote, "crystallized a revolutionary movement in the United States." By the end of the occupation, two American Indians had been killed, Buddy Lamont and Frank Clearwater. Buddy Lamont was actually from Pine Ridge. He was a Vietnam vet, well known on the reservation. The radio station now is actually named after him. But his great-grandparents were with Crazy Horse at the Battle of Little Bighorn, and his grandparents were survivors of the Wounded Knee Massacre. And Frank Clearwater was a Cherokee from North Carolina that had just arrived and was killed from a stray bullet from the FBI. As the FBI escalated their attack on AIM, the occupation became harder and harder to sustain, with no electricity and running water and supplies dwindling. The occupation pushed people to their limits. So after 71 days, at the request of Frank's Fools Crow, the occupation ended on May 8th, and the FBI came in and disarmed and arrested 120 people. Fortunately, however, many snuck out the night before evading arrest. Gladys Bisnett, who had been part of the occupation throughout, said on the last day, quote, "This was one of the greatest things that ever happened in my life. And although today is our last day here, I feel like I will always be here because this is part of my home. I hope that the Indians, at least throughout Pine Ridge Reservation, unite and stand up together, hold hands, and never forget Wounded Knee. We didn't have anything here. We didn't have anything to eat. But we had one thing, and that was unity and friendship amongst 64 different tribes. I have never seen anything like this." And today in Pine Ridge, there is a national holiday of a liberated day for recognition of this. By the end of the occupation, more than 1,200 people had been arrested nationwide in relation to the protest, and 500 elders were indicted. Most ended up being acquitted. However, Leonard Crowdog ended up serving a couple months in prison. So following the occupation of Wounded Knee, AIM's prominence started to diminish. This was kind of mainly a twofold result. First, because of the U.S. COINTELPRO program, which is the counterintelligence program that many in this room might know, helped murder many prominent Black Panther Party members, also infiltrated AIM and started to create a paranoid culture, almost questioning anyone they thought that was possibly an FBI agent. This wasn't completely unfounded in a certain degree. It put people very insular, not being very open to building the organization, because Douglas Durham, who is AIM security director, came out as an FBI informant in late 1974. He was also oftentimes the personal bodyguard for Dennis Banks. He was one of the main AIMsters who said Anna Mae Pequot Anquash was an informant who was later killed, and many suspect that the FBI agents were the ones who killed her because she would not cooperate. The FBI later found Leonard Peltier guilty of killing two FBI agents in Oglala, South Dakota, although the FBI admitted themselves that they did not know who killed the FBI agents and were more concerned about getting their guy rather than justice. It's important to note that there were three people accused of those murders. Two were let off, and they got Peltier on his own case. If you don't know much about Peltier, you should totally read a book called In the Spirit of Crazy Horse. He is still in prison today, serving two life sentences, and is one of the more recognized, along Mumia Abdul-Jamal, as being a political prisoner in the United States. He recently was up for parole in 2009. Obama refused to grant it, and as Obama was going out, he also refused to commute or do anything of his sentence. The second fold effort that the government took at stopping AIM was really was those who were arrested at Wounded Knee to go through long, drawn-out court cases that the government would actually never win, but it would drain the finances and energy of the organization. That happened across the country, as many AIMsters would be brought on little charges, but still had to go to court and fight tooth and nail, though the case got thrown at, many cases got thrown out. It merely bankrupted the whole organization. In addition, there were always disputes within AIM on the direction of AIM was going. The leadership was male-dominated, Dennis Banks and Russell Means in the front, and members such as Madonna Thunderhawk and Janet McLeod saw the need for Native women's to start their own organizations, which they started. The Women of All Red Nations formed in 1974 to fight American Indian women's health against sterilization of women and against racist mass Scots and cultural appropriation. And there was also a split that happened in AIM, which I won't get into much right now, but they're still around today in a certain level. They were at the Dakota Access Pipeline protest. You'll see their flags. They mainly work on local issues of racism, racist mascots. But in their heyday was really limited to 5 years, and that really rocked the country. But in fact, the legacy of AIM and the Red Power was really the biggest legacy, was overturning termination, enforcing the government to pass legislation to promote self-determination. I had mentioned the Menominee Reservation earlier. They had restoration in 1973. 75, there was a Self-Determination Act. 74, there was Indian Financing Act, Health Care Act. There was 1978, the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, which finally gave American Indians the legal right to practice their religion. The Indian Child Welfare Act. There was a list of acts that were kind of the result of this threat. Now, as socialists, we understand the limitations of reforms like these, but these had lasting impacts on Native communities. Their legacy lives strong throughout Indian country, where now you'll see countless hats of people saying have Native pride or Native and proud of it, where in the 50s and 40s you would not see that. People were ashamed to be who they were. Ultimately, AIM's goal of liberation is still being fought today. Natives are still being killed by the police. According to the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, Native Americans only represent 0.8% of the population, but represent 1.9% of those killed by the police. And they still are the most disproportionately group represented in prison today, and are still fighting for treaty rights. Today, we have seen, though, the largest Indian fight back since this time in the 1970s, with the rise of Idle No More in Canada, the fight at Standing Rock, as I had mentioned, countless other pipelines. There's a new pipeline that was just approved in Minnesota, Line 3. Winona LaDuke said, if they want another Standing Rock, let them have it. So we'll see what develops there. The Native Lives Matter movement, which was inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement. Awareness around AIM and a radical history of Native resistance is vital for us to learn from their lessons and how we can build solidarity. Though both Standing Rock and Wounded Knee 2 were led by Indigenous people, they would not have been possible without the solidarity of countless of non-Natives brought to the camps and the broader political fight that brought the foundations of the U.S. nation state into question. Two of Donald Trump's first acts were to green light the Keystone XL pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline. It really showed where obviously stood on this. And this year, he actually stated that Native nations were not nations, but another race, and that they would not be exempt from possible work for Medicare rules. This is important because this could be laying the foundations for a new termination. So we need to continue this fight. And the best way to honor Ames' legacy is to continue to resist and fight racism, discrimination, while calling on the U.S. for reparations, self-determination, but more broadly for Native liberation that fights for a world that ends the exploitation of the earth and the destruction of indigenous land and puts the fight against capitalism and settler colonialism at the core of the resistance. Without this, we cannot unite for a better world, and that's what we ultimately want.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.